Okay, this is the hour. Your phone calls now with Greg Little as we talk about Mounds, Edgar Cayce, Atlantis, and also the pyramids and his work in Egypt. All that next on Coast to Coast AM. Greg, you've got an article on your website talking about a Bigfoot encounter in the Bahamas.
Oh, my, yes.
Why don't you elaborate on that?
Well, Brent Rains wrote an article about that. Actually, it's a repeat of an article about a Bigfoot and some other creatures seen in the Bahamas and some other places. And in one of our trips to Andros Island, I wound up interviewing one of these guys who was a descendant of the Seminoles near Red Bay. In fact, he was the one who led us out to take a look at one of the DC-3s that we found in a very remote area that had crashed. In any event, on the way there, he told us about a story of about a stream bed that we went by, and he had tracked a Bigfoot in this area. He could hear it, and he looked at the tracks jumping from one side of this stream to the other and followed them. And he could hear the thing screaming. I don't remember the noise that he described. But then after that, we talked to several other people who told us some similar stories. Plus, there's the stories of what's called a Chicktarni, which is a creature specifically on Andros. I interviewed two older women, both of whom were fundamentalist Christians, who claimed they just swore that they had seen a Chicktarni, although they were scared to talk about it. And it is a creature that looks sort of like a dwarf. It has a human's head and a bird's body, and its feet are turned backwards. There's several mythologies about it. Now, anthropologists believe that it is based on a type of owl. In any event, my wife and I got back to the U.S., and we went to the University of Florida's library in Gainesville because we were actually looking up some other articles in some obscure journals. And we were trying to figure out about this stone wall we had found. So we looked through all these newspapers and the Bahamian Journal of Science, every single issue of it I went through. And then all of a sudden I stumbled upon all these Bigfoot sightings in the Bahamas in the 1970s, exactly when this guy said this thing had taken place. One after another, a rash of sightings, not only in Andros, but in Abaco and several other islands, really small islands there. And it just struck me as very, very odd. And these people that I talked to, I mean, they were serious. There was no reason for them to pull my leg or lie, and I haven't. I mean, I mentioned it in this article as all. I was commenting on someone else saying that there had been reports there. But that's pretty odd. And these things just keep happening. The thing that I guess I need to add, oh, boy, while we were there, the Chicktarni has a nest that is, in the mythology, the nest is two pine trees pushed together, the top is connected, and they build their nest in the top of it. So here we are going through this very remote pine forest, and just out of nowhere, I'm the first person that spotted it, I saw way up in the woods two trees pushed together at the top, big pine trees. And so we all walked up there, and there was a huge nest, about as big as a person, at the top of these two pine trees that were stuck together at the top, a Chicktarni nest. I mean, everybody we told, the Bahamians with us said, yeah, that's a Chicktarni nest. I said, did you know it was there? And they said, no, they'd never even been in this area because we were trying to get to this crashed DC-3 that we had to walk about 5 miles with. In fact, my father was with us on that trip.
Okay, that's the one you were talking about, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was just so odd seeing this thing. I've never seen a nest like that before. It was huge. It was at the top of these trees. And the two trees were, like, pushed together at the top and somehow connected. You couldn't see how they were connected, but the nest was between them both, and it looked like it had been sort of incorporated into the tops of the trees. Just strange. A lot of strange things like that.
Okay, let's go to some of the phone calls. Virginia Beach, Virginia. That's the home of ARE, right?
Yeah, that sounds like ARE.
Eric, first-time caller. Go ahead, Eric.
Yes, sir. I live on 24th Street. I believe it's on 66th or 60th Street.
60th.
And I've never been there. And there's a spa. They say it's a great place.
Well, you need to go. They have great massages there. They got a great. They got the Riley School of Massage. It's a very famous school.
My question for you, sir, would be: did he prophesize Jesus? Did he actually see Jesus, or or did he prophesy a god as well? Not a god. I'm not a little nervous.
Look, that's okay. I don't know if he talked about Jesus or any other.
Well, he did talk. He did talk about Jesus. Hey, good. Casey was a fundamentalist. He was a fundamentalist Christian.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And he did talk about Jesus. He didn't prophesy about Jesus. I mean, he didn't make any prophecies about Jesus. He said Jesus was a real historical person. Jesus was who he said he was. But the story is bigger. It's like the story Jesus tells us or that we hear, the main story, is not the entire story. There's more to it. The way I look at it, it's like the story that most people know about Jesus is about all they need to know. But Edgar Casey said a little more about it. And that's getting pretty deep. And there's actually specialists in the ARE that deal with that. But he was a fundamentalist Christian. And his beliefs remained fundamentalist pretty much to the very end.
All right. Next up, let us go to Olympia, Washington, west of the Rockies. CJ, welcome to the show. Hi, CJ.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
In response to the last caller, I think the Bible is full of paranormal events. You know, Jesus walking on water, rising from the dead, stuff like that. That's basically a paranormal book. But anyways, my question for you was earlier you were talking about ancient technology and consciousness and matter being one. You were talking about that earlier as part of the technology that Edgar Casey was talking about. Now, if you go back to, this has to do with UFOs, but if you go back to the Roswell crash, and all out of all the witnesses that have come forward, and remember, zero witnesses have said that it was a weather balloon. All of them have described it as being seamless, no parts, no moving parts, as if the beings inside were combined, were using their mind to control the craft. Now, can you go back to what you were talking about earlier about Edgar Casey, or what you were saying earlier about the technology that was consciousness and matter working together? Because if you look at UFOs, it appears that most of them appear to be alive as if they're controlled by the mind.
Of course, Casey didn't talk about Roswell. He died in 1945. But what I will say is this. Casey did talk about the interchangeability between energy and matter. He said the closest thing that we could understand God as is electricity. He said that God's not an electron. He's not really electricity, but that's as close as we could possibly understand. There does appear to be what I'll call a plasticity that can occur between energy and matter, matter being hard, energy being not physical at all in the sense that we think of. So between it, you have plasticity, and it can mold and evolve itself and shape itself in any way. But according to Casey, energy has an intelligence, and that UFOs that appear to have an intelligence and are genuine probably would be a manifestation of that energy then, according to Casey. But he didn't talk about UFOs per se.
Okay, very good. Thanks for the call. Let's go next to Port Huron, Michigan, east of the Rockies. Hey, Dan, go ahead.
Thanks. Hi, gentlemen.
Hey.
I was listening earlier about the Bermuda Triangle, and I had caught a program, and I was just wondering your take on this. Everybody has a theory or opinion of the events in the Bermuda Triangle. This program had suggested that it was Earth's black hole, and being a big fanatic of space, I found this fascinating because, you know, the gravitational pull and the magnetic fields around black holes are just, you know, such a mystery. And then the contrast of white holes, instead of eating and destroying matter and swallowing even light, a white hole spews out stuff into the universe. Well, this program had stated if you drove a rod through the Bermuda Triangle, it would come out the other side of the globe on what is known as the Dragon's Triangle, I believe, which is off the coast of Japan somewhere.
Yeah.
How would this work, being that it's on the ocean floor? Could maybe the oceanic vents have anything to do with that? Or just what's your take on that theory?
Okay. I am very familiar with the theory. If it's a black hole, the only thing I'll ask is, I mean, there is a real mystery in the Bermuda Triangle. I mean, there truly are some mysterious phenomena that are not understood. Lots of theories, like you said, but this particular theory, how come the water doesn't go into it? If it's a black hole, how come it's just an occasional ship or a plane? And why doesn't water go down in there too? Why isn't it all sucked in?
Like a whirlpool or something.
I understand the theory. It's clear that a lot of these planes are there. They haven't disappeared. They haven't gone into a black hole. We are finding the planes. I believe Flight 19.
The question is, why are they there?
Yes. The question is, why are these things disappearing? Why are they going into nothing or crashing and there's no maydays? They're just gone. What is happening? I don't think it's a black hole, though. I do know the theory. I know the people that put it forth. I just don't see that as a good explanation.
I don't see it as a UFO thing either. Do you?
Yeah. No. Well, there are some. You know, there's some
reports. I agree.
There are lights associated with some of this.
But
beyond that, yeah.
But not just in that region. There's right. something going on, whether it is caused by an ancient civilization. Like the Atlanteans that created a crystal, is something that's disruptive to guidance, communications. I love the theory about the waters creating this underwater bubble that sucks down a boat a ship instantly because it can't float.
That's right. They lose buoyancy. When the bubbles come up, it loses buoyancy. And I think that's a good theory, too, and I think it does explain some. That would certainly explain why a plane, you're flying there, and the next thing you know, you're in the water.
Yep.
Just like that. And a ship would just go straight down, too.
Let's go to Tampa Bay, Florida. Hello, John. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Go ahead, John.
Thanks, George, for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Greg, it's great to talk to you.
Well, thank you.
In 2006, Bill Donato and you were on your way to the Bermuda Triangle or to Bimini, and you stopped off in Tampa Bay to look at some giant stone anchors that were 4 feet to 10 feet above sea level. And you didn't see the giant stone anchors, but Bill Donato did. And what I'm wondering is what your take is on the fact that these are 10 to 15 times the size of the stone anchors you've been finding in Bimini, and that they're up 150 feet above the level of the rocks that you're finding. How does that interconnect with Atlantis?
Well, I know what Bill's take was, and I've read the articles on it. I probably read some of yours, too. And I'm familiar with them, seen your photos. I don't really know what to make of them. I think that some of them probably were utilized as anchors that's been theorized, you know, long chains or whatever, and probably, you know, the sea levels were once higher, too. I do not agree with the idea that Tampa was Atlantis, although chances are that during the last ice age, if Atlantis was in the Bahamas, as we believe, Florida would have also been a part of it. And the interesting thing is Florida has a lot of ancient canals there. We haven't even gotten a chance to talk about any of that at mound sites. They were building canals, and that fits Atlantis. But I don't really have a take beyond the fact that these are anchors. They are very different from what we found at Bimini. The ones we found there are smaller. And the ones we found at Bimini are pretty much identical to Phoenician anchors. What you found there are pretty darn unique. They are gigantic stones with telephone pole size holes drilled through them. But I don't have a take beyond that. They're truly enigmatic as far as I know.
All right, thanks.
Okay, you got it. What do you do next? What are your plans, Greg?
Well, we go back to Bimini in a week.
You're going
to
do it, huh?
We are going to try and film every one of those 35 formations. We are going back, actually, to finish off these hundreds and some spots that we have left to look at on the Great Bahama Bank. And one more oddity here. Back in the 70s, you're probably familiar with this, but there was a story of a guy by the name of Ray Brown who found a crystal in a pyramid off the Berry Islands. And it was supposedly in deep water, and he dove down and got a large crystal that was in the in some sort of a holder, like two hands in the apex of an underwater pyramid. Now, I have investigated that story, and I've always thought the story was nonsense. I'm actually more of a skeptic than a believer, and I know you know that because we've talked
yes.
many times. But in any event, here's what happened. Our contacts in the Bahamas, which trust us a lot, they have found off the Berry Islands and I've had them searching for us for a while there. They have found what looks like a pyramid, large stone blocks arranged on the bottom in multiple levels, almost a multi-tiered pyramid. I don't think we'll find a crystal there. Ray Brown took it. But we're going to go and investigate that also. I've got to go see what this thing is. And I believe him. There's something there. I just don't know what it is. But it sounds a lot like Ray Brown's pyramid. I almost hate to say that.
All right, let's take another call. Let's go to Denver, Colorado. Marshall, it's your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi, Marshall.
Hello, George. And thank you, gentlemen, for having such an engaging conversation this evening.
Thanks.
I had a question. First of all, you were talking about the Vinamie Road. How do you, if I were to look that up online, what exactly would I look for? How do you,
Bimini,
what is
well,
that?
Just put, go to Google, put in quotation marks, Bimini, B-I-M-I-N-I, and then a space and R-O-A-D. Close your quotes, and then you'll get a lot.
You'll okay,
see
great.
Everything Thank- from what skeptics say to what we say.
Okay, and I have been seeing quite a bit on the age of Aquarius, which is allegedly coming into play in 2012, so to speak, with all the talk and whatnot with the Mayan calendar and all of that. Is there any sort of relation, Greg, that do you see in any theory between ancient civilizations coming from, like, the star system of Sirius?
The only thing that I'll say is that Edgar Cayce never mentioned 2012. There is a lot written about 2012. The Mayans did, and not the Aztecs, but the Mayans did talk about 2012. We have been at the site at Piedras Negras, Guatemala, where it's the only site that has both the creation day 3114 BC and 2012 on the same rock stela. And we filmed that there. No, I can't tell you that I can answer that personally. I can tell you, too, that Edgar Cayce did say there was an extraterrestrial visitation into the Maya lands. And I think I told George before that actually made me nervous when I read it, because I don't like contemplating that. I am sort of a skeptic. But Cayce did.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, Cayce said there was some sort of an extraterrestrial visit in the Maya lands. And it's just kind of weird. I don't know what to make out of it. But there's only three readings in Cayce's that look extraterrestrial. One is that, and the other two are about the Atlanteans getting messages from non-earthly influences, intelligences, the same way that I believe that a lot of the crop circles are being made. People are getting messages, and they are almost like robots then carrying out instructions.
Absolutely. Yeah, I had seen... there was a crop circle next to Stonehenge, I think, in the mid-90s that had a spiral effect, which was allegedly from certain sources, like a map or a blueprint for like zero-point propulsion and different forms of traveling.
Well, there's no doubt that there's messages in the crop circles. The question is, where are they coming from? Where are the messages coming from? The ARE put out their first book on crop circles. They have a new publishing house called Fourth Dimension Press, and that British guy, Andrew Collins, put out the first book on it. It's called The New Circle Makers. And in it, Andrew tells the story of walking into his first crop circle in 1977. But he believes there's some sort of intelligence involved in the making of crop circles.
Greg, we're going to come right back and wrap things up with final phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. Our next guest on Coast to Coast will be Linda Godfrey. We talk about the Beast of Bray Road as we trail Wisconsin's werewolf. So get ready for that program. When we come back, final phone calls with our guest Greg Little on Coast to Coast AM. What's going on around Puerto Rico, Greg? Anything special there beyond the chupacabras?
I don't know of anything going on there besides that. I used to spend a lot of time there, but I haven't in some time.
So it's quiet on the front.
Yes. By the way, we didn't get to mention this. There will be some news coming out of Egypt. The ARE is continuing to do work at Egypt. The ARE supplied a drill that was used to put three holes into the rock around the Sphinx. A camera was dropped in. This occurred just a couple of months ago. They hit water. And there is an opening down there. There is something beneath the surface, a chamber or whatever. Zahi allowed the ARE to ship a drill over, and the ARE is going to continue to do more work with them. It's actually now a formalized arrangement.
Is Zahi a little more open, or is he still keeping these cards to his
I don't think he's any more open.
No.
But the ARE has been involved in things quietly there for a long time, and it's not what I would call quiet now, but it's Zahi has to walk kind of a tightrope between a number of different things. But the truth is, I don't really know how much longer he'll be there, and there'll be somebody else at some point.
Yeah, absolutely.
Probably sooner than later.
We may broadcast out there sometime next year.
Yeah, very good.
Right by the base of the pyramids, but who knows? Maybe they'll uncover the Hall of Records while we're there.
Maybe. There is a plan to do the area that Andrew Collins went to do the caves, and I suspect National Geographic or History Channel or somebody will be there when that's done.
Of everything that you've investigated, Greg, in your career, what has fascinated you the most?
The truth is, the thing that's fascinated me the most is really mounds. That may sound odd, but it's that they are so complex, and there's so many of them, and they have geomagnetic anomalies around them. There's so many weird experiences people report associated with mounds. Mounds are also, I mean, all these things connect together. They're very ancient. The American mounds are older than Egyptian pyramids. The oldest mounds now are in Louisiana. They date to 3800 BC, 5,800 years ago. And where these people came from is a complete mystery. So that's probably the most amazing thing. The most amazing things right now, which need to be finished, are these rectangular formations off of Bimini, because they do look like remnants of Atlantis. And I don't say that. I've been very, very cautious with all the statements we've ever made about this search for Atlantis. We've never gone overboard with anything. But these really do look like buildings, and we know they are on the 10,000 BC shoreline. And then you've got this thing in Egypt. There really are caves and tunnels under Giza. They've been entered. There's hundreds of photographs of them. The documentation will be out soon in a book. So there's a whole lot going on here, a tremendous amount going on. And I don't know what's going to break and be the really big news first. I know there'll be a lot of interest once all these documentaries start showing, though.
Okay, let's go now back to the phones. We'll go to Gainesville, Texas. Teague on the wild card line. Hi, Teague.
Hi,
good morning.
George. It's actually Gainesville, Florida.
All right.
Hey, I was wondering, that area near where you were talking about, the Berry Islands.
Yes.
At the tail end of that, I think near a place we used to call the Fish Keys, possibly, there's a thing we used to call the Blue Hole. Have you been there?
No, I have not. No. Tell me about it.
All right. It's in the middle of, some of those islands over there are tiny, so it's only maybe 40 acres, this little island. And in the middle of it is this lagoon called the Blue Hole. On the edges of this lagoon, now it goes like straight into the island, straight down, and it goes down deeper than we could scuba dive anyways.
Sure. Yeah, I know.
But then in the middle, there's a column coming up to maybe within 30 feet of the surface.
Huh.
It seems very unnatural. I was wondering if you were going to be in the area.
No, I'm not familiar with it. What's the name of it again? The island.
We used to call it the Blue Hole, and it was the east side of the Berry Islands as you go around from Chubb past Whale Key, and I think we used to call them the Fish Keys, maybe?
I got you. Okay. We'll check it out.
Anyways, if you're in the area, you should check it out.
I thank you for that, Will. I like all these. I like getting little hints like that, leads. That's good. We'll check it out.
You don't have a huge research department, though. You're doing it all by yourself and with your
wife. My wife and I do this by ourselves. We employ some Bahamians with us. We occasionally take some other people with us. We do not accept funding from the ARE. All these other things I've discussed are ARE funding, but we don't fund it, but we don't do that. We try and stay independent, although the skeptics keep saying that we get funded from the ARE, and they've stopped saying it. I've had to force them to stop saying that because we don't. We haven't taken anything from the ARE.
Ever have a harrowing experience on one of your travels?
We have had several. The scariest one was going into that Autech thing.
Yeah.
That was stupid because it was bad weather. The other one is when we tried to go over and meet National Geographic, our boat. My wife and I got a boat specifically for these things. Well, an 8-foot wave came up over, and I'm running the boat, you know, being the captain, and I'm sitting down, and in less than a second, it's like a quarter of a second, you go from being totally dry and having the whole inside of the boat dry to it being just totally filled with water. I mean, instantly, totally filled, swamped. So we turn, and this boat is made, it's a catamaran, and it's made to be, it's supposed to be unsinkable, and that was very scary. We turned around. We were prepared for an emergency, but not something like that. But we had a special portable bilge pump, and it had bilges. It cleaned it out, and we did fine. But we then flew over for that one.
Let's go to Springfield, Illinois. Andrea, east of the Rockies. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi. Go ahead, hon.
Oh, okay. I just wondered if the state of Virginia was part of Atlantis. I always felt that way.
Well, Edgar Casey said it was a special place, and Edgar Casey also said that Atlanteans fled, that Atlantean survivors fled there, and their descendants stayed there. But as far as it being part of Plato's Atlantis, most people would say no. But it was some of the lands in existence when the Atlanteans fled, and that's what Casey said.
What makes you think it was part of Atlantis, Andrea?
Just a feeling, past lives, just a feeling.
Okay.
Nothing wrong with just a feeling. That's how things happen quite a bit. Bellingham, Washington, west of the Rockies. Stephen, it's your turn. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, how are you tonight?
Good, George? We're well, thanks.
I have two questions covering two of the different subjects. And by the way, Dr. Gregg, I appreciate that you're skeptical. You're a scientist. You're supposed to be, right?
I try to be. I try to. You know, the word skeptic has taken on a different meaning. It means a disbeliever of anything now. I mean, skeptics are true disbelievers. They don't believe evidence that goes against their beliefs. I go where the evidence goes.
Mm. And regarding that, regarding the mound builders, this is my first question. There was controversy in the 19th century over, there was disagreement by...
Who built them?
Yeah. People couldn't agree, scientists couldn't agree on who built them.
Yes.
And they don't seem characteristic of anything that Native American tribes were doing. So what would it take to get a couple of them open today?
Well, first of all, loads of mounds have been opened in the past when the NAGPRA law, Native American Grave Repatriation Act, passed. The Smithsonian supposedly had over 10 million skeletal remains, that most of which were removed from mounds that they had to then have reburied. Lots of mounds have been opened. The one you're probably talking about is when I mentioned Cahokia, and it's very difficult to do that now to go into any Native American grave, so there's not a lot of archaeology being done into the mounds. As to who built them, I'll readily say that they were built by the ancestors of the current Native Americans. The real question is, where did all those current Native Americans come from? Their ancestors didn't all come from Beringia in 9500 BC, like we've been told for the past 70 years. We know now there were people in the Americas for a long, long time, and there were various waves of migrations into the Americas from different places, from the South Pacific, clearly from Siberian Asia across Beringia in 9500 BC, and maybe from certain European lands. But that's the question. Where did they come from? And where did they get the ideas from? Mounds and pyramids are everywhere in the world. The ones in America I find most interesting. And the ancients built with what they had there. In Egypt, they had two things. They had stone and they had sand. Well, you're not going to build a sand mound. That's called a sand dune, and it'll blow away. So they used stone. Our people here built mounds. They built earth. And where they had stone, they actually used it. You still see some stone mounds in Ohio, and there used to be some huge stone mounds in West Virginia, which were dismantled, and the settlers actually used them for buildings then. So that's the first question. What's the second?
The second one is regarding who would own these ruins in the ocean, could any nation, is it possible that the United States would just jump in at some point and say, well, we claim this? Different countries may have interests. Would it go to the island nation closest to the find?
Well, are you talking about the remains we found at Bimini?
Yes.
And that's owned by the Bahamas. And as soon as it's recognized, the interesting thing here, it's like a catch-22. And you'll see a lot of films and documentaries where I'm scuba diving and I'll move stones at the Bimini Road to get under them. And we've pulled wedge stones out and pulled up anchors. And the reason we're allowed to do that is because it's not a recognized archaeological site. The skeptics have written that it's all natural. Everything there is natural. Even the anchors, they're all natural. That some sort of boring worm caused them. And that every single thing there is natural. There's no human artifacts whatsoever. And you're allowed to move stones there. You're not allowed to disturb coral, and we don't do that. But you can move stones. That's not illegal. But as soon as it's recognized as an archaeological site, the Bahamas own it. The Bahamas will regulate it somehow. And I do hope that it is recognized as an archaeological site. And something may take place after this documentary comes out. I believe the one on Atlantis is in November, as I recall.
Have you done any work, Greg, about the possibilities that Atlanteans through Egypt may have come to North America, hidden artifacts and things like that apparently have been found?
Yeah, there are several very, very curious things that appear to be Egyptian. Not just, some people would point to rock carvings that appear to be Egyptian petroglyphs. But there's a story of a temple site found near the Grand Canyon in a labyrinth of a labyrinth of rooms, some of which are as large as a gymnasium would be, carved into a mountainside in the 1800s. Actually, I believe it was great in 1899, I want to say. We have since found and matched it up with something that was found in 1997 called Casamalpas, which is a site in New Mexico, and they've closed it off.
And what's that site look like, Greg?
Well, it's near the Grand Canyon, and it's a Hohokam site, but on a wall of a canyon, there is a tunnel that was discovered. And the tunnel is a little tube that goes in, and inside of that is a complex of hundreds of rooms carved into solid stone. They are square and rectangular rooms, some of which are as large as a gymnasium with 20-foot-high ceilings. That has been closed off and sealed, and that is the exact description of the room where hundreds of Egyptian artifacts were supposedly found by a Smithsonian expedition in 1899. And that was actually in an Arizona newspaper. I don't believe it was a Smithsonian expedition. I believe the site was looted, and when they got caught, they claimed they were with the Smithsonian, and that's what the newspaper printed. And that's what we actually wrote in our Mound Builder book back in 2000. But yes, I believe there's been a lot of stuff found that looks Egyptian here and definitely probably is Egyptian.
Okay, let's go next to Los Angeles. Gabriel, first-time caller. Hi, Gabriel.
Greg, how you guys doing?
Okay.
Hey, I got a story for you.
Sure.
So I'm down in the Yucatan, Quintana Roo area a couple years ago, and I'm with a friend who's from, Europe, and I see him coming from a restricted area. I'm like, hey, what are you doing over there? He goes, I'm down checking out the Atlantis Temple, mate. I'm like, no, man, whatever. So that blows by. A couple years later, I go back with my nephew and my friends, and we're on the Ruta Maya. And to keep me occupied, I pick up a little book called Mayan Myths and Legends. The last story in that book talked about Atlantis falling and that the queen sending out these 13 boats to different lands. And one land you're going to go to is, she kind of described the Yucatan because she said, you will build a pyramid in the story above a river, a caved river, which are the cenotes. So anyways, I have friends that do security, and we go on this undercover tour to these ruins. And there they have this temple that they call the Atlantis Temple. And
where
the doorway there, this is off air, I'll tell you exactly where, or I'll give you my email. But yeah, this is really cool, man, because when we get there, my friend Haji's like 6'4". He gets to the doorway, and there's still like a foot above his head. All the other temples and Mayans are smaller.
They're really small, yeah.
Real small. So the carvings on this temple are not even Mayan faces, man. They're different features. Now, in front of this temple is a 25-foot diameter stone, 25-foot diameter turtle.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see the head of the turtle, the back, and the stairs, have the, at the end of the stairs and the back are the tail and the legs. Then the guy tells us, he goes, right here, he goes, they dug up, he goes, they never realized it, but they just dug it up a month ago. If you guys would have been here, I would have showed you a picture. I mean, I would have showed you the body of a 7.5-foot giant.
Greg, how do we get your email out? We've only got about 30 seconds left.
Go to my website, mysterious-america.net, and look at some of the articles. You'll search around and find it, or send one to the editor of the site, and he'll get it to me.
The book, The Illustrated Encyclopedia of Native American Mounds and Earthworks, your latest work. Where do you get it?
Well, you can get it at Amazon. It was made for libraries. It's a hardback, cloth hardback, but it's available through Amazon.
Everything, all your work. It's fascinating.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Best to your family, Greg.
Thank you so much, George. It's always a pleasure. You got a great show.
I'm telling you, you have brought us so many fascinating things. Hot people can't go to sleep. Now they got to think about this.
Well, this is the fastest 3 hours.
It does fly by. Thank you so much, Greg. You take care of yourself. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.